We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, Episode 7. The purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming Black real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors. We are now on Apple Podcasts as of last week. So for all Apple users, definitely check us out there. Like, share, subscribe. Looking forward to being added to other platforms over time. Before we jump into the episode, there's a couple of things I want to talk about. One is the power of social media. Over the last couple of weeks, I've been contacted by several investors who don't live in Ohio, but invest there in Dayton. And it just shows the power of social media and putting yourself out there. A lot of people have been hitting me up with different things and opportunities and just advice. It's been great. So I've had really awesome conversations with others who are investing in Dayton about why they chose the market, what their future plans are. And I'm looking forward to building relationships with them and building relationships with other people who are in the real estate game. Something else that I wanted to discuss is the importance of learning your market. And so as an investor, it's very important to learn as much as you can about the market you're currently investing in or one that you have interest in. Things like podcasts, city development plans, which are readily available, changes happening in local neighborhoods and specific neighborhoods where you're interested in investing. There's a podcast I listen to called New Dayton, and it's about all the exciting things happening in the community. So things such as new creative spaces, fresh food markets, new restaurants, things of that nature. And it's been really cool and, you know, shows where this development is happening, where all these new things are popping up, which helps as an investor thinking about what you want to do in the future and just keeping a pulse on the community. So it's important to, you know, news, take some of those things with a grain of salt, but it's even more important to get the perspectives of the locals and those who are living in that market. Something else is that I'm speaking at an event this Tuesday, a real estate meetup. And so if you're in the LA area, I'll be speaking at a meetup with an experienced investor. This brother is based in New York City, and I believe he invests in that area. And so we'll be sharing our stories, how we got started, and it'll be followed by networking. You don't need experience. This is not anything formal or one of those things you're paying $7,000 for. This is completely free. There'll be refreshments. And so if you're in the LA area, if you're interested in learning more about real estate and networking with like-minded individuals, definitely join us. Send me a DM if you're interested, and I can definitely share more information with you, RSVP link, all that good stuff. Also, shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. They released their new issue last week, and you can become a member of their network for free. So if you want to just collaborate with other minorities who are pursuing entrepreneurial ventures, you definitely want to check them out. And you can find them at mint_inc on Instagram or their website, mintinc-usa.com. Lastly, I want to make a plug for a resource in our link tree. So the Real Estate Summit Bundle is a 13-part online course jam-packed with real estate investing strategies organized by our recent guest, Kendra Barnes, at The Key Resource on Instagram. So you'll learn about investing out of state, short-term rentals, mobile home investing, seller financing, property preservation, house hacking, tax liens, buying holds, and so much more. You can get all of this for 50% less than the original price. And so you can find more information on that in our bio. The link is there. Very excited about this episode with Panji Barnes. You're going to learn so much. I'm excited to check it out again. Look forward to hearing from you all. Let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. I'm very excited about this interview we have today. Today, I'm interviewing Panji Barnes, a real estate investor out of Chicago, Illinois. Panji, thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's start off with you telling us about what your childhood was like and what you saw or what you didn't see that shaped your view of building wealth.
Okay, so I grew up a little interesting. So I come from a two-parent household. My parents were married for like 23 years. So my father worked for the city as a repairman on like the city buses. My mom, she ran their side business. They had a mechanic business. So he had two. He had a side hustle. He had a regular job. So my father, when, you know, I was growing up in the 90s, he spent about like $100K alone just from being a mechanic for the city. And then he had a lot of money from his business as a really good, auto repairman. So entrepreneurship, I was just grew up in it. Like I would spend my summers answering the phone for my dad's company. So, but the interesting way about how I grew up is, I lived in the middle of hood. So I lived among so much poverty, but we were doing really well. So that was interesting. To be around so many people that had so much lack, and then we had, so which made us targets, because you know, if you're doing really well in a neighborhood that, you know, everyone else is like poor and can barely keep their lights on, but you can go on vacation and you can do different things and put your kids in private schools and things like that. So that was, quite an experience. But entrepreneurship is in my blood. My grandparents, entrepreneurs, my grandfather actually helped build the Sears Tower as a bricklayer, a black bricklayer. So I have a rich history of real estate. They own a lot of real estate. So honestly, I just kind of feel like my destiny was kind of like, you know, written before I was born with entrepreneurship. So,
wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. What was it like as a child, just seeing your parents do well in their careers, and also that the fact that your dad had something additional, had a side hustle? What was that like, just seeing that?
So the two takeaways I take from that is you have to delegate. I saw my father exhausted and unhappy. That's what I saw, because he was working a full-time job and then he had his business, which was booming, but he didn't know how to like let control go. So he wouldn't hire, or sometimes he would hire really cheaply people out of school. So they're not as experienced. So they need a lot more hands-on help. So he didn't want to spend the money to actually, you know, get experienced mechanics, which would have helped him, you know, sleep better and enjoy, you know, the fruits of his labor, but he didn't do that. So I quickly learned that if you're going to grow as an entrepreneur, you have to delegate, you have to trust, and you have to create systems. Otherwise, you become a slave to the very thing that's supposed to give you freedom. So that's what I kind of took from that. Yeah.
Wow. That's profound. And then you also mentioned your grandfather as well. He owns some real estate.
Yeah, so they own a lot of real estate, around the like Chicago State University. So he's passed, but my grandmother, she still owns the property. So she's held on to the properties. And so, yeah, you know, and then a lot of my family members, my uncles, you know, cousins and things like that, they're in construction. So it's just really in our bloodline, seriously.
Definitely. That's an awesome visual. So what inspired, so you saw a lot of great things growing up. You saw entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. you saw real estate investment. You just had a lot of great examples, but what made you want to get into real estate for yourself? I read a bit of your story and mm-hmm. kind of how you started off, but tell us about why you personally decided that you wanted to get into real estate investing.
So I really honestly never would have thought I'd be doing this, because I wanted to be a lawyer. So I got into real estate because I was broke and I was in college, and I was during that time, it was like a real estate boom. So if you guys don't remember, if you're like too young to remember, but they had it where like in 2004, between like maybe 2003, 2007, like anybody that's breathing and can like sign something and get a loan, And so it was nothing for me, for people to get a mortgage. So I'm 20 years old and somebody pre-approved me like millions of other Americans for a mortgage. And so I was looking at these TV shows, Flip This House on TLC, HGTV, all these shows that are saying like, these people were going in putting carpet and painting the walls and they're getting like 100K profit. So I'm like, I'm very ambitious and, you know, I wasn't your average college student. I wasn't, you know, partying and stuff like that. So for me, I was like, if they can do that, I can too. And so me and my husband, we found a condo and we figured we'd flip it. And unfortunately, we flipped it at the time when the market was falling. So I actually had to bring money to closing. So it wasn't, my first deal wasn't the best deal, but I did learn, you know, you learn from all your failures. So, but yeah, that's kind of how I got into it because I thought I was going to get rich. So, which it can make you rich, but not in an overnight type of success that I was thinking as a naive 20-year-old. So, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. And what I like about that is that you took an action. Mm-hmm. At the time, you probably didn't know if it was a perfect option, but you're like, you know what? I got to do something to get into this game. And, you know, obviously you've grown a lot. You've grown a lot now. And I think something that stops a lot of people is just being afraid to take that action. You know, having enough information, enough resources. You know, there's some people who did all the research. They have what they need to take mm-hmm. action. They're just sitting on the sidelines. So I really like the fact that you did it. You did something. And I'm sure you learned so many lessons that have helped you get to where you are today.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, don't get like the analysis paralysis, right? Those people that read, they've read 35 real estate books. They've listened to all the podcasts. They've shadowed somebody and yet they still, you're like, did you buy anything yet? No, I still kind of want to run my number. So here's the thing. It's never going to be perfect the first time around, but get your feet wet, get in the game. Like, you know, it's the worst thing that can happen is you foreclose and you just buy something in 2 years. I mean, like it's not that big of a deal. So yeah. Yeah. It's important to get past analysis paralysis. Yep.
Definitely. Definitely. Can you dive a bit deeper into that first deal, like the purchase price, you know, if you had to use FHA, conventional, all that good stuff.
So this was a 100% financing deal, which was very easy to get back then. I purchased the condo. It was a 2-bedroom, 1-bath. I purchased it for $145. It didn't need much work, just some cosmetic updates that we did to it, granite countertops, different backsplash, the hardwood floors we got refinished, but just some paint, like, you know, like under $10,000. But I think we didn't understand that, like, because I bought it at such a higher price, the resale value on it wasn't that high. And, you know, I didn't run my numbers. I didn't even read a book. I just kind of found an agent and like, hey, they pre-approved me. Go show me a house. So my numbers were off by the time, you know, for the most part, the biggest lesson that I learned from buying condos is what really kind of, you know, made my deal so bad is I had a special assessment. And that special assessment was, you know, I think $7,000 or a little bit more than that. Yeah. So when, you know, they basically ran the numbers, it's like, you got to pay the special assessment, property taxes. You told the buyer you're going to get them 3% back and close. Like, so once you run all of that, it was nothing left. So my attorney called me while my husband and I are like cheering for the fact that we sold it. And he's like, I need you to come to closing. I'm like, why? Because you have to have some money that you need $1,100 to close. I'm like, what? I'm bringing money to closing. So it was very sad, but you live and you learn. And so actually the numbers were horrible that I ran. And so it cost me. And like I said, that special assessment really killed me, which is why I haven't bought a condo since. Well, I did buy a second condo that year, but that was because I was under contract. But since then, I haven't bought another condo because those special assessments are really scary to me. Even though you can do your due diligence and ask them if there's one upcoming, but you just never know. So, yeah.
Definitely.
So yeah, we sold it for $162,000, something like that, around that number. So as you can see, if you buy for $145,000, you put money into it, and then you only sell it for $162,000, we still have to pay all these commissions, realtor commissions, and assessments. So that's why the profit was gone so quickly. So yeah.
Definitely. Can you explain what a special assessment is?
So a special assessment is something that a condominium board will assess on the entire, all the owners. And this one was for, because the building needed new tuck pointing. And also our boiler system was really bad. It was, couldn't bring heat to all the unit owners. So we had to replace that. So what they do is they total all of what it'll cost to make the repairs for certain things in the building, and then they split it between owners. And that's what a special assessment is. It's just, you know, it's a big, if you may need a roof or you know, tuck point, or you may need new windows or whatever it is. And then they just make all the owners pitch in for it. So in addition to your monthly assessment fee, so you know, you pay monthly assessments. Well, this is also an additional amount. So yeah.
Wow.
So be careful with condo purchases. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's crazy, because yeah. I've heard different things about condos and things of that nature. But I had no idea about that special assessment stuff. And it seems like, I mean, it could happen at any time. Like,
oh, yeah, just, absolutely. Right? Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's
part owning a condo, yeah.
Definitely. And when you say 100% financing, does that mean you didn't have to put anything down?
Nothing.
So yeah. It was like that back then.
That's how easy it was back then. Yes, very easy. Yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. My goodness.
Yeah, wow. I mean, and like, just to put to you how easy it was, they wanted proof of income to get this loan, and I bought eBay receipts that I printed out from PayPal. Like, I had like a little eBay business where I was selling like stuff online to make money in college, like little sweatshirts and things like that. And so I printed out my PayPal receipts for eBay and used that, you know, as proof of income. So,
wow.
Yeah, just to kind of tell you how crazy it was, the Wild Wild West back there with financing. So, yeah.
My goodness. Wow. Wow. So where are you at now? How many units do you have today?
13 doors. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Are they like a mix of multifamily, single family?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Multifamily, single family, and commercial. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So how did you, so going from, you know, condo, you kind of got it off your hands, you sold it. How did you grow from there? Like, what was your strategy? Like, how did you get to 13 doors after that?
Yeah. So I bought another condo. I was under contract when I was selling the other condo. So I bought another one in the building, flipped that one, and actually made a nice profit. And then I took that profit and I bought another property and I flipped. So during the time, I was just doing a lot of flipping. I didn't become a buy and hold investor, which is a landlord, until 2012. So I started doing this in 2005 and I was just kind of like flipping. And then because the deals, even though the market was like to get a loan was hard, but a lot of the real estate was really cheap. And my husband had got a great job. And so he was making enough money where we would just save up and just buy a lot of these properties, you know, cash. And we, you know, financed, you know, flip and flip. So then in 2012, I kind of got sick of flipping because just of all the stress that comes along with flipping in terms of making sure you have a buyer and it's not on the market too long and all these different things. My realtor kept telling me, well, I think you should just become a landlord. And I had such a bad taste in my mouth about becoming a landlord, like most people do. But I found something that was kind of turnkey. And then I found a renter and, you know, it actually was a good experience, my first experience as a landlord. Like, it wasn't a nightmare. And so after that, like, I just was like, I prefer this better. It's residual income. You know, a lot of times I'll go 3 or 4 months without having to go over there, you know? So for me, I was like, okay, this is freedom. And I'm not like worrying about holding costs and all these different things with flipping. So that's when I got into just more like, you know, doing the landlord thing. So yeah, that's what I like to do so far. Single family is my favorite. I feel like those tenants stay longer as opposed to like multifamily. It's a higher turnover. Usually like with single family, my average renter will stay about 5 years. So that's why I like single family. And I feel like they treat it as like more of a homeowner. And they take care of the property a little better. Like, they kind of take it on as their own home. So, yeah.
Wow. That's really cool. That's encouraging. I just closed on a single family home in Dayton, my first ever investment property last week. Okay. So I'm hoping my tenant stays for 5 years too.
Congratulations on that. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, typically single family, you know, tenants do stay longer. They, you know, they feel like they kind of make it into their home. So as long as you like stay on top of keeping them happy in terms of repairs and things like that, I think you'll be good.
Definitely. So a lot of people have interest in flipping. I haven't flipped before. Not a lot of people I know have flipped before. How was it difficult to become good at flipping and running the numbers and all those things and the timing? Like, what is that process like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tedious process that you want to make sure you're not, like, you know, rushing into, because you have to make sure those numbers on top, because there's many things that can come, like your contractor. What if he runs off with your money? You know what I mean? I've heard of people having to start all over because they got a bad contractor who kind of, you know, they paid to do work, and then now they have to, that work still has to be done, and they have to get back into the budget. Or there are things that are unforeseen. You know, maybe when you started the project, it was a $30,000 project, and now it's turned into something $40,000+ because you took those walls down, and there's corrosion behind the walls, or, you know, termites, or, you know, different things like that that come up that you have to account for when you are flipping. The market might have been great when you looked at it, and your real estate agent looked at it and said, you know, like, these properties are selling at this price. And now you have a downturn, and so now you have price drops. So that's cutting into your profit, or it's not selling as quickly as you thought it would. So now you're paying a mortgage or holding costs, and that property, you know, you have to pay that so that the bank won't come and take your flip. So if you go with a hard money lender, that's even more pressure, because they have tight, stringent, you know, requirements in terms of, you know, how short term the loan is. So yeah, there's a lot to be taken into consideration. I would suggest someone get, like, a mentor if they're going to do flipping, and just, you know, make sure those numbers are correct. And yeah, so that's my best advice, is mentorship, and, you know, try to run those numbers as accurate as possible.
Definitely, definitely. And when you were flipping, how did you manage contractors? Did you pay them on a schedule? Were you calling them every day? Like, how did you keep them accountable and make sure your money wasn't just going out the window?
Yeah, you definitely have to pay them on a schedule. But the contractors that we did have, you know, we kind of gave them leeway to do what they need to do. My husband did a lot of the work as well, so he would be there some days doing work with them because his work schedule is flexible. So that's another great accountability, is someone that's actually there, and, you know, they have to show up and do the work. Because sometimes, you know, if you take your hands off the wheel on these, you know, people will do what they want to do. They'll tell you that they got sick, or, and they're working on another job, you know, because contractors do that. They will take on all these different jobs, and then they will neglect yours because, you know, they got payment on it, or, you know, they feel like you're not, yours is not as urgent. So I would say that, you know, holding them accountable by showing up when they're there. And then also just, yeah, payment schedules to reward them. And if they get done quicker, you know, maybe get incentives inside the contract. Hey, you know, you get a 10% increase in the pay if you get it done quicker, or a penalty if you don't, you know, things like that. Making sure that the contractors is actually a licensed contractor, bonded. You want to see some references. You want to see work that this person's actually done within, like, the 3 months. Because sometimes contractors, general contractors, will all also have turnover. So maybe, like, one project 6 months ago that you saw pictures of, it looks great, but it wasn't the same electrician. It wasn't the same mudding guy. It wasn't the same, because they've turned over those guys. Now they have new guys who are not as professional, or, you know, not as experienced. So the work looks different now. So I would say just, you know, making sure that, you know, the contractor actually has done legitimate, great work, good references, and making sure that you hold them accountable on as far as payment goes. Don't pay up front for anything, you know, please don't do that. I would say, like, for contractors, when you're getting started, if they're a reputable contractor, I would say no more than 10% down, because a lot of times if they're getting started, it's just demo work. So why do they need payment up front? I mean, if you're paying for materials, that's one thing, but I would say, you know, they have to do some actual work for you to start making, like, 30%, you know, those type of things. I wouldn't say 50% up front. I think that's way too much. But I don't know, some contractors, they want that, but you just have to be careful, because there's a lot of scammers out there. So, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm glad that you dived deeper into it and what it takes to do it successfully. Yeah. Because, you know, we look on TV, we look on social media, and it's kind of glamorized. I mean, there is a great reward at the end, right? When you sell and you get your money. But I want people to understand that you have to basically what you shared is you have to put a strong team together. You have to hold them accountable. It's almost like, it sounds almost like a small business because
and,
you have to
and
make
that's
sure.
Why, exactly. And then you see why I'm a buy and hold investor.
Yeah.
I mean, I do flip like, you know, once a year, but for the most part, I don't like this. It's too much to be like, people do this as a career, you know, but I just can't. It's just too much. Sometimes it's just too much. And just making sure those numbers are correct because those closing fees add up, like those bank fees and paying your realtor fees, 5 or 6% of the selling price and closing, all those things. I mean, you know, sometimes I look at my sheet, what I'm paying on closing might be $15,000. So imagine if your margins are real. You walk away, you did all that work for what? For 5 or 10? Like, come on. Like, you know, so you have to make sure it's worth it because it's a big headache and it really is another job. So, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. About how many flips do you think you did during that period of time?
Probably like 8 to 10 flips.
Yeah. Got it. And roughly, I guess on average, how much did you end up coming away with on each flip?
Actually, I do pretty good. So like on average, I probably did about $50,000 and the best I've done is like $80,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
And, but you have to understand that I'm a big proponent of sweat equity. Like, I know there's a lot of people out here that like to just, you know, sit on the sidelines. I'm okay with painting. I'm okay with, like, doing certain things, like tiling. Like, my husband's okay with putting some kitchen cabinets in. We don't mind getting our hands dirty, but not every investor is like me. So if it means more money for me on the bottom line, for me to go spend a couple weekends to paint or whatever it is and not pay a couple $1,000 to a painter, I'm okay with that. Like, so it just depends on what type of person you are. If you don't want your hands dirty, just be prepared that you're going to have less of a bottom line. You don't mind getting in there and kind of helping out on some of the stuff that, you know, I'm not doing plumbing, electrical and stuff that professionals need to do, but painting, you know, is not going to hurt you. You're going to save some money there. You know, if you know someone, your husband, or you can put cabinets in, that's not a big deal. Countertops, I wouldn't say go put grand counter. You need a professional to do that. But there are certain things that you know you can do. So yeah, I'm a big proponent of sweat equity, which means my bottom line is a lot healthier than other people's.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I really like the fact that this is real. This is real, and I appreciate that. And you know, yeah, you know, you made the sacrifice, got in there, got your hands and elbows and all that dirty, and went in there and did what you had
exactly.
to do.
Exactly.
So that's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. So from flipping to getting into being a landlord, were you mm-hmm. able to use, for the properties, so you're at 13 doors now, was most of that funded through, you know, savings and money from the flips?
Absolutely. So for the most part, I buy with cash, you know, I don't do a lot of financing. I'm not really big on leverage, I'll be honest. I know that's a weird. They're going to tell you to go out and get 15 mortgages and get a cash flow of $200 per day. Like, I'm just not that type of girl. I prefer to buy cheaper properties, which I can buy in Chicago all day long, and buy them for, you know, cash, fix them up with my money. And if I want, I can refi. I've done refinances on them, but I might only take 30% out as opposed to taking 70% out, which is what a lot of investors, they pull all the equity they can out of there. I sleep better at night because I know that I don't have a ton of mortgages over my head. But that's just me. You have to kind of figure out what, you know, is comfortable for you. But I'm not big on completely leveraging your entire portfolio. And which is why I've grown so slow. I mean, there are people that have started maybe 4 or 5 years ago and they have triple what I have, but they have a ton of debt too. So, you know, you just kind of have to choose, you know, what comfort level in terms of debt you're comfortable with. So, yeah,
definitely. I'm sure it gives a lot of peace of mind not to have all those mortgages either, because, you know, let's say you had 26, but you refinanced, mm-hmm. the cash flow on each, in theory, could be the same as you get now, but with more properties, more things.
Yeah,
to
yeah. Exactly. Which I found that when I'm networking other investors, they're making the same amount, but they have more headaches, more tenants calling. When I, you know, I'm making the same amount with less headaches. Yeah, I don't have as many units, but the cash flow is the same. So I always tell people, focus on cash flow and what your goals are financially, what you want to bring in monthly, or what you want your net worth to be, and not so much just being able to brag and say, oh, I have 50 doors. Well, if that's only bringing you $5,000, like, is that worth it? Like, that's too much, but that's 50 people calling you. That's 50 tenants. Like, is that, you know, you can get a property manager, obviously. You're not going to do that alone. But I'm just saying, like, you know, you have to also justify the debt you're going to take on. So, yeah.
Definitely. And are your properties concentrated in a certain neighborhood in Chicago? Are you kind of spread out around different neighborhoods?
I'm spread out a little bit, but for the most part, I like investing in Morgan Park. So I invest a lot in Morgan Park. One is because, it's kind of like a pretty decent area. Also I do a lot of Section 8. So with Section 8, they recognize this area as an opportunity area, which means opportunity area just means like, it's great for like, it's a great area to live in. They're just saying like transportation, there's access to good education, healthcare, things like that. So because of that, they pay me more. They also give me a tax break on my property taxes. And they also give me an incentive of an additional rent when I rent to them. So for me, and then, you know, it just makes sense for me. So I like investing in that area, and I really hate to say it because it's like an investor secret to let the cat out of the bag, but it's a great place to, you know, invest. And it's like, you can find a lot of different cheaper properties for like under $50,000. So yeah. That's one of my favorite places to invest. You know, there are other places, you know, Auburn Gresham, there's another Washington Heights, Pullman, Inglewood, Woodlawn is up and coming. I don't have anything there, but I would like to. And then like South Shore, so I'm looking at some stuff over there. But yeah, for the most part, I like Morgan Park. So yep.
Definitely. And can you speak more about Section 8? This seems to, I don't think the general population really understands what it is, and I've just in talking to people have learned more about what exactly it is. So can you explain Section 8 and your experience with it?
Yeah, so it's a government federally funded program for people that are elderly or poor, and they basically, the government pays, give them a voucher for them to live wherever they want to live, for the most part. And so in my experience, I've had very bad and I've had good. So I will say that if you're doing Section 8, the screening is imperative. Okay. Don't skimp out on it just because someone tells you that they have a voucher. You need to screen. Also, another thing I like about Section 8 is in many instances, not all, but they will pay more than market rent. So let's just say, like, everyone kind of knows that Inglewood is like the hood. It's really scary sometimes over there. But you can buy like a house over there, and you know, a market tenant is not going to probably pay you $1,600, but the government will. So maybe you buy something in Inglewood for $15,000, you fix it up, and, you know, you're getting paid $1,600 on, you know, it might be like a 4-bedroom to get that type of money, but there's actually really good money to be made over there. And that's why you see people that are outside of Black people that own property in the hood, and they are making really good money, and they live in the north suburbs, but they invest right on the south side of Chicago in the worst areas, because they know that's guaranteed rent, and that's a great, and that's how they make their living. Like most people, right? They come into our neighborhoods and they, you know, extract from their liquor stores to nail salons to the cheap real estate. So, I think Section 8 is a great thing, but just be prepared. With Section 8, they are very, very needy people that they need a lot of like hands-on attention. So with market tenants, they're going to handle certain things without calling you. Section 8 people are going to call you. You know, it's so funny because they don't have any skin in the game, yet they hold you accountable for so much. And it's so weird because you'll see a tenant that works every day that pays $1,500 cash and they don't bother you much, but then you'll see a tenant paying you $10 that's constantly calling you. It's the weird, it's weird, but it's the norm, you know? So just be prepared. When you get that, it's good money, but it also comes with a little bit of a headache. And I'm young, so I can kind of deal with that. And at some point, I'm going to get a property manager. I had two before, but I fired them. But at some point, I'm going to look again for a property manager. But it's not easy, but it's worth it, is what I will say. The money is really good. So, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. That's great. That's great. So 13 doors, around how much in cash flow does that generate a month?
It's a pretty good amount of cash flow. You know, it's a healthy amount. We do pretty well for ourselves.
And they're all free and clear for the most part, right?
Right. Yeah. I have like maybe a couple that I refied on, but for the most part, free and clear. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I want to touch on something you mentioned. You mentioned that you fired two property managers. So I take it that you currently self-manage?
Yeah.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the experiences with the two property managers.
Well, one property manager, it was a really large company. And I think because we were small mom and pops, they just didn't give us the attention that we needed. I think they, you know, they had really large companies that they were managing for, and we just weren't a priority. So a lot of stuff that you know, we needed to get done wasn't getting done. And then with the other person that we had, it was just an individual. He was actually a broker, but he also did property management on the side. Now with him, he was attentive, but he didn't have like the crew. So a problem would occur, and then, like, let's just say a toilet got clogged. So the tenant would call him, but then he would call us and tell us and ask if my husband can go out and take care of it. So I didn't understand that dynamic, because I'm like, where's your plumber to go out and take care of this? Why am I calling a plumber? And why are you asking me about my husband? Like, how are you a property manager? Like, property managers have teams of people, handymans, plumbers, or like whatever it is, and they go handle the problem. And then they tell you what it costs, and you say yes or no. And that's how that works. So that didn't work for me, because now I'm still managing you, you know, and you're asking me to do additional things. So that didn't work. But you know, right now we're self-managing, but eventually I'll start looking for another property manager as we begin to grow. So
definitely. And what is, and so, you know, feel like there are two camps of people. There's one, I'm not doing anything, I'm getting a property manager for everything. And others are like, you know what? It's not that bad. It's not that hard. I'll just do it myself. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to us about the realities of self-managing and what it's been like overall for you?
I mean, it's definitely a pain in the butt at times. I mean, we went to Jamaica last week and we had 3 phone calls from tenants, 2 for broken down furnaces and 1 for like an electrical outage. Like, I mean, and we have teams of people. So the great thing is we called, you know, the HVAC guy, and he was on it. And then we called our electrician, and he was there that evening. Teams are very important. You can't do everything. But the fact that I got that phone call while I'm on vacation is annoying. So, you know, you get those type of things. But then I look at it, because a lot of them do not call for months and months. Now, I do quarterly inspections. But if you're one of those people that just don't want to be bothered, I get it. So you have to figure out, and you have to also have good personnel skills. Like, you can't have a bad attitude dealing with your tenants. Like, you're gonna have a lot of turnover, and you're gonna just have tumultuous relationships, and it's just not gonna be fun. So you have to have some sort of, like, you know, good personal skills to deal with people, because they're going to call for problems, and you can't just bark at them. You have to be attentive to them. And I just kind of look at it like that. Like, either you're in it or you're not. Like, you can't do that. It's customer service. Like, it's just like if you worked at Wendy's or something. I mean, you just can't yell at your customers. So I will say that you have to be able to do, if you're not a people person, don't do it, because it's very annoying. Like, I can't tell you how many times I roll my eyes when I get these text messages or phone calls from people, but I don't let it show, you know, because I just feel like if I'm getting something once a month and I'm getting this check, like, you can't have too much of a bad attitude about it. But it is very hands-on, and it is, you know, it's work. But, you know, if you don't want to do that, just get a property manager and then they'll just call you and tell you, or you can say, hey, if it's under $200, don't even call me. Just fix it and take it out my rent. But if you really are, you know, nitpicking your money and you want them to call you, that's fine too. So, yeah.
Definitely. And what has been the most challenging tenant experience that you can recall?
A tenant that just didn't want to pay rent for the Section 8. She just was not. I think that for the most part, what I've noticed in with dealing with Section 8 is that the worst thing you can do is tell some of these people that you're the owner. So I think that this lady had an issue with me being so young and her being so old. So it was like a power struggle. And so I should have never done it. And I never do that now. Like, I used to wear it as a badge of honor. Like, oh, I'm the owner. I just say that I'm a property manager, you know, and
you are.
That's the end of that. Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of my properties are in LLC. So, you know, it's no big deal. But I think that, you know, with her, she just had it in it for me. Like in the beginning, it was great. And then it was like an issue where I was telling her certain things that weren't acceptable in terms of cleanliness. And she was personally offended by that. And it was just, you know, a headache. She was calling CHA on me constantly. I was failing inspections because of her, which cost us to go on abatement and things like, which cost me to lose money. I finally was able to get her out of there. But, you know, that's why I say, like, it's so important to screen, because just because someone gives you a voucher doesn't mean they're, like, you know, a good tenant. So, yeah, I would say that's one of the worst tenants I've had. And she didn't want to pay any rent, which is just mind-baffling to me that, you know, you don't want to pay your rent, which is the only way I got her out of there, is because THA is like, you're not paying rent. So, yeah.
Wow. Wow. I'm sure a lot of lessons learned from that experience. Cool. So we touched on this a bit off camera, but I want to talk more about my experience in Chicago and just ask you some more targeted questions about the city. So my sister moved to Chicago in July, and I spent the week with her, just kind of helping her out and you know, checking the city out. So we went everywhere. We were in you know, Hyde Park, different areas on the southern part of the city, and we also drove through Englewood. You know, I'm a basketball fan. So, you know, they said, oh, you know, that's where Derrick Rose is from. So I'm like, you know, we're going to drive through. And so we get on, I think it was West 63rd. We saw a Whole Foods, and I don't know where we're going. We're just driving. We're just wandering around. And we see, you know, abandoned buildings, open land, what looked like, you know, abandoned warehouses. And I was telling her, I'm like, you know what? There's going to be two people that see these. See all these properties. There's going to be one who thinks it's just trash, it's community's garbage, and there's the other who will see, you know, this is an opportunity. There's an opportunity to, you know, invest in the community, make it better for the residents who live in it, provide resources, provide good, high quality housing, and also to make money. And, you know, at just the whole week, I was just thinking about how the media paints this picture of Chicago that, from what I saw, is not representative of the majority of the city. And so, you know, I also, you know, people are just afraid of Chicago. People are afraid of investing in Chicago. I mean, even when I told some people I'm going to Chicago, just like, oh, you know how it goes.
Right.
So why do you think people buy into that? You know, the picture that the media paints, you know, we've been having this conversation and I see people from Chicago who are all doing well. I saw it with my own two eyes, and we're talking now. You seem to be doing well. So can you talk to us more about that?
Yeah, a lot. Basically, this idea that if you invest in Chicago, you're investing in war zones, which is not true. You know, there's only, like, there's small segments of where you would consider war zones. It just isn't true. And, you know, I'm going to tell you personally, like, we go look at properties. When we're looking at properties, guess who's leaving when we're going? White guys or Middle Eastern people, okay? That's who I'm competing with. You know, I bought another property, like, in West Pullman, and there was a guy, a white guy, who owns, like, five or six properties on this one block. Well, he was pretty pissed off when we bought a property. We bid against him and we won. And, you know, the tenants were telling me like, yeah, then that, you know, our landlord was pretty pissed off that you guys got that property. He lives in Northbrook. He's making all his money off this block with CHA, with Section 8. And he's living comfortably and he comes in and picks up his rent. And he thought that he was entitled to buy the rest of the block, you know? So like, why are you guys, you know, some people have these, you know, stigmas or like, you know, negative connotations about investing in Chicago. Plenty of people are getting rich off of it, very wealthy. And so I think it's a great place to invest. I think it's pretty, I will say this. I think it's one of the few places that you can buy a property for $20,000 and put like maybe 15 or 20 in it. And it's worth like $150,000. And I did that on my last deal, you know, like I bought a property for $20,000 next to a property that sold for $195,000. Now, is that insane? Literally next door to each other. Sold for $195,000 last year. I bought it for $20K. I refinanced it and the bank appraised it at like 140 something after I put like 15K into it. I don't know too many places you can do that into. But Chicago is one of them because there's places in Indiana. I could go invest in Indiana. It's very landlord friendly. What's one thing I hate about Chicago? It's tenant friendly. I could go invest in Indiana, but guess what? If I buy a $20,000 property, it's worth $40,000. That's not worth it to me. The values here are a lot more because people want to live here. It's a great place to live. It's a great place to invest. And so I think that if people are scared, that's more for me. So that's kind of how I look at that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just crazy. Like based on what you shared, you were just saying, you know, there's this, you know, this white dude who owns 5-6 homes on the block. It's like, someone's going to make money off of it. So we could either talk down our communities or we can actually buy back the block and not talk about it, give people good housing, make money, provide them with something good. And keep our communities intact, you know? So I hope
there's pride in owning something. I think I like when I have to go to my tenants and I see the little, you know, children and, you know, I have black tenants. And so I think that's great that they can say, oh, my landlord is a black, you know, because you don't see that growing up. You mostly children probably see white men come in or, you know, other races that are coming in and they're collecting the rent or, you know, they're talking to their parents about the lease or whatever, but they're looking at somebody that looks just like them. My kids come with me and they see my little, you know, they play together and stuff like that. I think that that's a great example for these children to have, you know, that you don't have to live in poverty. People like that look like you own property as well, you know? So yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we need to consider that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I definitely agree. That's a great visual for the kids living in the properties. And, you know, let's talk more about your kids. How involved, like how much do they know about what you and your husband are doing, all the investments and properties? How aware are they of what's going on?
They're very aware. So, you know, my husband has to go do something at the house. He takes the kids with him. They also look at payroll. So they're looking at, you know, rents and things like that that are coming in and expenses. They will go look at properties. They don't always like to go look at properties with us. A lot of complaining, but we're like, dude, this is your inheritance. So, you know, come on. But we try to involve them as much as possible. You know, my son will be 10 next year. He wants me to start bringing him when I start screening tenants and meeting with tenants, just so my son can listen to the questions that I ask and how I, you know, deal with tenants, just so he can have that, you know, experience. So we try to include the kids as much as possible so that they can actually take our portfolio and grow it or, you know, do whatever, you know, they can carry that and also pass it out to their children or whatever. So, yeah.
That's amazing. That's what it's all about. I'm sure, you know, by the time they're 18, 21, they'll understand what y'all were trying to do and, you know, they'll just take it even further. I'm sure by then, you know, you'll probably own half of Chicago by the time they get that old.
Oh, yes.
Definitely. So I was doing some research, and I know you have a book and different resources. Can you talk more about the different, books, courses, and so on that you have to help newer investors?
Yeah, so my book, Real Estate and Chill, it's on Amazon.com. It's also on Audible, on Amazon and iTunes. And basically the book talks about, it's specifically written for new investors. So it talks about, dealing with how to find a great real estate agent. One of the tips I talked about in the book is trying to find an agent who's actually an investor. Because you get like mentorship with that, because they have like a special eye, because they own property or they've done flips and they have rentals. So they can really help you make a really great decision and help you with those numbers so that you don't make, those mistakes in the beginning. I'm also talk about financing and, owner financing. I also talk about tenant screening and, systems put in place to tenant proof your home, property management. So many things that this book talks about, really great reviews on Amazon, no fluff, just kind of share a lot of some of the pitfalls that I made in the beginning that people don't have to make. I talk about how to deal with contractors, some of the contracts you can show them. So yeah, it's a really good book. A lot of good feedback from it. So I would definitely encourage you guys to pick it up if you want to. And then I also have like a course, about real estate investing that kind of deals with tax liens, Section 8, buying on auctions, because sometimes I'll buy on auctions online. So, and real estate investing in general to help people that are new to it. And that's on rechill.info.com. And I think that's pretty much it. And you can find me on Instagram at Real Estate Chill. So,
definitely. And what inspired you to write a book?
So I had a lot of I have two brothers and they're like in their 20s, but their friends were always so curious about, because sometimes I would borrow them to do little stuff and they were very curious about real estate investing. And so I would like recommend books, but I don't think these kids read the books. So I was like, I have to write a book that relates to millennials. So that's why I named it Real Estate and Chill, because kind of like off a play of Netflix and Chill, I'm trying to reach millennials. I'm trying to explain and trying to, relate to them as much as possible and trying to, condense it so that it's entertaining but also educational. And so that's kind of what I did in the book so that people, that were interested in real estate investing, that they could get the real meat and potatoes from it. So.
Absolutely. And I also read that you had a furniture rental staging business.
Yeah. So, in that 2008, period, I got a real staging company, because when I would flip, people would always tell me that they really loved the design. They were always like, who staged it? So I decided to do a staging company. So I got an office, and then the office had an upstairs warehouse. So I bought all this furniture. I bought a big box truck. And, I was like a stager and I did really well with it. Like most of my clients were like Northsiders because they had the money to do it. What really kind of stopped me is I got pregnant. And so, cause I was like really hands-on with my business, meaning that I went on the truck with the drivers anytime there was a delivery, just to make sure everything went well. So, when I got pregnant, like I had a really bad pregnancy. So my doctor told me I couldn't participate in my staging anymore. So, when I went on bed rest, I was kind of like, not hiring. I was hiring like family and friends. And like, so what happened was they would be delivering stuff and they would be like tearing up people's properties going into it. Like, you're not wrapping the furniture correctly. Like I would tell them if I was standing there, because, but this is why you have to delegate and get managers and things like this. The lesson I learned from that. But they weren't wrapping it correctly. And then sometimes they weren't professional movers. So they could be nicking like the drywall, which would piss off sellers, which they would call me and curse me out. Cause they're like, I'm trying to sell and you have your movers in here and they're like moving it wrong. And they're nicking up our hardwoods and they're nicking up the walls or whatever. So basically it kind of just fell apart because I just didn't, even understand how to get, a manager to kind of like, or get professional movers. So I had everything, but just not the right, people in place to run it. But I learned so much from that business. But yeah, I had that for 2 years. Then I went to law school in 2011. And I did that for a year before I dropped out of law school because I really hated law school. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer, but I went back to real estate investing. So yeah, I've had an interesting journey. So yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. That's awesome. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned law school. So, you know, you went to law school, you decided it wasn't for you. I respect that because, you know, conventional wisdom would say you started the program, you need to finish it. It doesn't matter, you know, whatever the case is. What gave you the boldness and the courage to just say, you know what, I've done this for a year. I realize it's not for me. I know people may say this, they may say that, but this, I know this is what's best for me and that's what matters. What gave you that boldness and courage to go forth with that decision and jump back into real estate investing?
It was really hard because I was thinking like, this is so embarrassing. Like I had told all these people I was going to law school and I was going to be a lawyer and now I'm going to have to drop out this program. So yeah, it took a lot of courage, but I'm really one of those people. I hate regret. So for me, a lot of the things that I do is motivated by the fact that like, I don't want to think about at night that I didn't do this or that. So I was thinking like, okay, you can stay in law school and you can incur all this debt to please other people who don't give a crap. And if you don't work as a lawyer, then they're going to even judge you more and say, well, why did you go to law school? You're not even practicing law. So I'm like, okay, so either I cut my losses and pay for this loan that I have for the first year and go do what I really love. Because when I was in law school, some of my classmates would laugh and they're like, you're not even paying attention. You're in school and I see you on your computer looking at real estate. Because that's where my heart was. I went to law school to please like my parents because they were thinking like, well, you know, I thought you were going to be a lawyer. So I was following somebody else's passion or purpose they wanted for me instead of my own. And so it was a good experience because I would have been thinking, you know, well, I was probably supposed to go to law school, but at least I've experienced it. I know it's not for me. I love what I do today. I love teaching people about real estate. And I just, you know, I love passive income. I love building wealth this way. So this is more suitable for my home life and for me. So, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And, you know, people probably thought you were crazy at that time, but look at you now. You know, you're probably,
exactly.
Seriously, you're probably doing much better than some of your classmates.
Absolutely. Seriously.
All due respect to them, but, you know, mm-hmm. you, I just think that goes to show you have to do what's best for you. You know, sometimes Absolutely. If you don't follow the path that's laid out for everybody in society, people will think you're crazy until they see you succeeding. And
exactly.
That's just the bottom line. So I think it's amazing that you went forth and did that. Mm-hmm. A couple more questions as we wrap up. What is one goal that you are working towards accomplishing by the end of this year?
Well, actually, I'm trying to be an Amazon bestseller for my book. So that's one thing I'm working on right now. So, that's pretty much it, you know, as far as my goals. Right now, we're still kind of doing a couple rehabs on the commercial building that I bought. So just doing some gutting with that. But that's one of the goals.
Absolutely. And I encourage everyone to purchase this book. We'll have it in the show notes and make sure everyone knows about it when this comes out. It's an excellent resource. And, you know, for all of our people, you know, there's someone who looks like us that wrote a book. If you want to invest, purchase the book. If you don't want to read it, listen to it on your way to work, at the gym, the audio version. There's no excuse. This is something you want to learn about. Go on and purchase the book.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring real estate investor who's just looking to get started and doesn't really know where to begin?
Get started and don't get overwhelmed. I think that I get a lot of DMs from people that are like, well, I want to be, you know, a real estate investor and I want to buy a 5-unit or 6-unit. Like, slow down, just buy one, like just start at one, right? And then you can kind of build on top of that because sometimes you might hate it. Like I have several relatives that when we see each other on the holidays, they like, I don't know how you do that. Like, I don't know, I did that and I hated it. So you got to make sure it's something you actually love. I mean, well, you don't have to love it, but just something you actually want to do, because I, like I said, I know a couple people that are just kind of like, I hated it. So don't go out and buy an entire portfolio. So I would say, you know, my piece of advice is to slow down, build slowly. And then once you get the momentum going and you kind of, you know, have a good feel of where you want to take your, you know, real estate career, then you can kind of like build from there. But just, you know, buy a two flat, or if you don't want to buy a two flat, buy a single family and maybe buy it in a place with a lot of tourism so that you can Airbnb it out so you can make extra money. I always say, don't buy real estate just to get the American dream. Buy it because it's a source of income. So that's why I always say to people, get an FHA loan, get a 2-4 unit property, let the tenants pay for your mortgage. You live rent free. If you don't want to do that, let's just say you're an entrepreneur and you want to own a restaurant, and but you work like a 9-to-5, get a mixed-use property. I have one. It's a commercial at the bottom. It's a residential at the top. FHA actually will finance that.
Really?
So you can have a restaurant or a boutique or a barbershop, whatever your dream is, and that mortgage is paying for your career, your, you know, your business, and your actual roof over your head. So that's another great way. But yeah, just take your time and, you know, start at one.
Definitely. Okay. Got to start somewhere. You know, mm-hmm. I talk to people or just see things online, and a lot of people are like, you know what, until I can buy a 10, 20 unit, whatever, I'm not starting. And I'm like, yeah. All right, cool. Well, I'm going to buy this little single family home and see where it goes. I'm buying something, yeah. Doing something.
Exactly. That's the right mindset.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then once again, where can people find you?
I'm on Instagram at Real Estate and Chill. I'm on Facebook at Real Estate and Chill. You can email me at ponjib@aol.com. And yeah, I talked about my book, and yeah, that's pretty much the spaces you can find me. I'm very active on Instagram. So
definitely. Yeah. I check into the post every day. A lot of good knowledge, knowledge and helpful tips. Great. Well, Ponji, thank you so much. This has been a great interview, just a testament to, you know, just doing what you have to do, doing what you feel is best for yourself, finding neighborhoods to invest in where other people may not invest. There's just a ton of great nuggets and lessons in this episode. I'm excited to play it back and take some notes myself. So thank you so much for taking the time tonight.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed this interview.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to the Black Real Estate Dialogue. You can follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. Definitely hit me up if you have any questions. Let me know what you think of the episode, what you think of our posts and everything as we continue to grow. Appreciate you all supporting the podcast.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.